God became human. God became a man. The creator of all that has been created, the eternal God, became one of the creatures that He Himself created. It's the most unexplainable thing that God has ever done. Of all the miracles, the incarnation, God becoming human, is the one that is the most inconceivable, the most difficult to wrap our minds around. The all-powerful God became a human baby, utterly dependent on His own mother for life. The one who was all-knowing had to learn how to walk and how to talk and how to read. The Creator God, the one who created everything that has been created, had to learn how to chop down trees so He could build something with it. The one who was eternally self-existent, who needed to rely on nothing outside of Himself for His own continued existence, that one got hungry and thirsty. See, the incarnation is simply unexplainable. It's impossible for mere humans to comprehend. You see, when God the Son became a human baby, He came to earth, everything was completely turned upside down and backwards. There are a lot of reasons God became man. One was to sympathize with us. There's nothing that we experience that Jesus Himself is not familiar with. Also, Jesus came to show us how to live. But the most important reason God became man was so that God could die. God became a man so that a man could bear the penalty for our sin. Now, what we saw last week, His kingdom, it's upside down. It is backwards. It's a kingdom that is not built by conquering other kingdoms. It's not built by engaging in battle. It's actually built by Him dying in battle. His kingdom grows not by force, but as men and women all over the world willingly bow their knee, willingly confess, Jesus is Lord. This baby that was born about 2,000 years ago is none other than God Himself. That's how His kingdom grows. That's the right response, to bow the knee and recognize Jesus is Lord. Well, in our text today, we're going to see the wrong response. So if you have your Bibles, turn with me to Mark 14. We already read the text, but we're going to read each part as we walk our way through it. So Mark 14, let's look at verse 53 again. And they led Jesus to the high priest, and all the chief priests and the elders and the scribes came together. And Peter had followed Him at a distance, right into the courtyard of the high priest. And he was sitting with the guards and warming himself at the fire. Now, Judas has betrayed Jesus. We saw that last week. For a few coins, Judas led a group of armed guards to arrest Jesus in the middle of the night in secret. Now, the chief priests and the scribes, they want this over quickly. Jesus is popular. He heals people. He feeds lots and lots of people. He's a popular guy, so they don't want to cause a riot. And so they want to have Him arrested at night when nobody is going to riot over it. They want it done as quickly as they can. Now, you have to understand, the group of armed men who come to arrest Jesus are a lynch mob in the middle of the night wearing hooded sheets. Okay? These are not honest, upstanding, law-abiding enforcers of the peace. These are thugs come to arrest an innocent man, to abuse him, to beat him, to nail him to a cross, and ultimately kill him. See, Jesus is innocent, but He's not innocent like you or I are innocent. Right? I mean, if you accuse me of murder, I'm innocent. I've never killed anybody. Right? But I've actually committed some crimes in my life. I've done some things that are wrong, and so I may not be guilty of that particular accusation, but I'm still guilty. There's still lots of things you can pile up on my record and say, see, not innocent. That's not how Jesus is innocent. When we say Jesus is innocent, we mean He is innocent of any crime you could ever accuse Him of doing, no matter how big, no matter how small. Did He murder? No, He didn't murder. Assault? No. Speeding ticket? No. Greed? No. Lust? No. Waking up grumpy after a late night? No, Jesus is innocent. Whatever the accusation is, Jesus is utterly, completely, thoroughly innocent of any crime. And yet in this upside-down way He's building His kingdom, the one who is innocent of any crime is being arrested in a garden so that He can be abused and punished for the crime He didn't commit. But Peter's there, right? There's hope in the story. Peter is there, right? You saw him in the text, didn't you? Well, I mean, he's at a distance, but he's in the vicinity, right? He's with the very men who have arrested Jesus. It's actually quite fitting that Peter is there, because Peter is just as guilty for what is about to happen to Jesus as the guards are who arrested him. We have to remember, the arrest and the betrayal of Jesus, the death, the crucifixion, and the resurrection of Jesus, it's all part of his plan. None of it is a surprise. Mark has shown us throughout the entire Gospel of Mark that Jesus is in control of the circumstances of his entire life, all the way through his death, through his resurrection. Everything is happening as Jesus said it would happen. So Peter is sitting with those who are guilty as one who is guilty along with them. Peter is one who is in need of the death of Jesus, just as the guards need Jesus to die. Again, Peter may not have been the one to arrest Jesus, but he stands before Jesus as one who is in need of Jesus and the mercy and forgiveness that is only available through Jesus. Peter needs to die, or he needs Jesus to die, so that his sins can be covered, including his sin of abandoning Jesus in Jesus' darkest hour. The fact is, there is no other way. It was just a couple hours before this text that Jesus was in the garden praying, desperately pleading with his Father for some other way. His Father said there was no other way, and so Jesus rose up to be arrested and to go through what he's about to go through. Verse 55, and we'll read through the first part of verse 61. Now the chief priests and the whole council were seeking testimony against Jesus to put him to death, but they had found none. For many bore false witness against him, but their testimony did not agree. And some stood up and bore false witness against him, saying, "We heard him say, 'I will destroy this temple that is made with hands, and in 3 days I will build another not made with hands.'" Yet even about this, their testimony did not agree. And the high priest stood up in the midst and asked Jesus, "Have you no answer to make? What is it that these men testify against you?" But he remained silent and made no answer. Imagine the scene. The chief priests and the scribes, the other members of the Sanhedrin, are there, and they desperately want to get rid of Jesus. They despise Jesus. They absolutely hate him. They want him utterly removed from the scene. But no matter how hard they try, they can't find anyone to testify against him in a way that will cause the Roman government to come in and authorize his execution. Mark says they were looking for testimony against him that was a capital offense, something that was worthy of his death. I mean, if you want the government to kill someone, all you got to do is find some evidence that they've done something that is a capital offense, right? A capital offense is a crime that has death penalty as the consequence. So all they have to do is find out Jesus did or said something that would offend Rome so much that Rome would come in and kill him. They can't find it. They can't find a single person who can testify against Jesus that he did or said something illegal so that Rome would execute him. All they had to do is show that Jesus was inciting a rebellion of some sort. If they could do that, Rome would be swift. It would be over. They would nail him to the cross immediately. They wouldn't need a trial. See, Rome was quick to crush any hint of rebellion. It was a massive empire. And if they had a nation that they had conquered want to rebel and overthrow Rome, they had to send their armies to defend the empire. Everybody had to move around on foot, though. I mean, they didn't have cars. They didn't have trains. They didn't have planes or ships to send people on. They marched across perhaps thousands of miles from one side of the empire to another. And so they had soldiers stationed all over the empire, small groups of soldiers. And if there was any hint of rebellion, that rebellion was crushed immediately so that it didn't grow into a much larger rebellion requiring the entire army to show up. But they can't find a single person who will testify that Jesus said something, anything about revolution. His kingdom is an upside-down kingdom that will not grow through military might. Even though Jesus could destroy whole armies with just a word, all he has to do is speak, and the power of his command would destroy an entire army. Even though he had that kind of power, his kingdom isn't built with military might. Jesus isn't a threat to Caesar. They can't find anyone to say so. Now, you got to remember why Mark is writing. He's writing to the believers in Rome. the very city of Rome. He's explaining to them why they worship a man who was crucified, who was condemned by the Roman Empire, who was crucified by the Roman Empire, but then who rose again on the third day. And Mark is saying he was not a rebel against the Roman government. He was not inciting a rebellion. He was innocent of any crime they accused him of. Mark points out, even though they found people to testify against him, their testimony didn't agree. They weren't reliable witnesses. One said one thing, another came along and said something else that completely contradicted the first guy. But then they find someone who has something to say that has its basis in fact, even if he got the details wrong. Verse 58 again. We heard him say, I will destroy this temple that is made with hands, and in 3 days I will build another not made with hands. So again, we have one of these so-called witnesses, and they're not really credible witnesses. Jesus did talk about rebuilding the temple, but he didn't say he would destroy the existing temple. Look at this from John chapter 2. So the Jews said to him, what sign do you show us for doing these things? Jesus answered them, destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will raise it up. The Jews then said, it has taken 46 years to build this temple, and you will raise it up in 3 days? But he was speaking about the temple of his body. Now the Jews were asking him, we want a miraculous sign to verify these things you're doing and saying. And Jesus said, destroy this temple and I'll rebuild it. Now he left off the implied you. If you destroy this temple, I will rebuild it. He never said that he would be the one to destroy it. See, and the sign they need is after they kill him, he is going to be resurrected from the dead. That will be the sign they need. So Mark says, they don't even get their statements correct. They sort of quote him, but it's a broken quote. It's an inaccurate quote. They need to check their sources again. Now here's the amazing thing about this. In spite of these accusations, Jesus remains silent. He doesn't speak a word in his defense at any point in this trial. He's not concerned with being right. He doesn't idolize the opinion of other or the opinions of other people. He's not concerned about his reputation. So why does he remain silent? The fact is, we've seen Jesus respond to people before in the Gospel of Mark. People often try to trick him into saying something to get him into trouble with the authorities. In fact, in Mark chapter 12, the last occurrence this happened in the Gospel of Mark, they came to Jesus, they tried to trick him, but Mark says, Jesus answered them, and his answer was so profound, he shut them up. Nobody dared to challenge him in a verbal competition again. They were afraid of the man. You can't trap him in his words. He'll trap you in your words. He'll turn the truth on you. So why is Jesus silent in this kangaroo court? Verse 60. The high priest stood up in the midst and asked Jesus, have you no answer to make? What is it that these men testify against you? But he remained silent and made no answer. Why did Jesus remain silent? If Jesus answered their questions, he would have silenced them, and the trial would have been over. And then he would have had to die. Jesus came to die, and so he must remain silent in the midst of these accusations. The truth he speaks is so powerful, it would have gotten him out of the trial. It would have ended immediately, but he can't have that, and so he remains silent for a while. See, speaking truth to these accusations would have freed him. He's only silent when he could have freed himself. Look at the second half of verse 61. Again, the high priest asked him, are you the Christ, the Son of the Blessed? And Jesus said, I am. And you will see the Son of Man seated at the right hand of power and coming with the clouds of heaven. Now, the high priest here is asking really two questions in one. First, he says, are you the Christ? Are you the Messiah? Lots and lots of Jewish men during that era had claimed to be the Messiah. And none of them were ever accused of blasphemy for it. Now, blasphemy is speaking evil of God. It's attributing something bad to God, saying God is the cause of this bad thing, this evil, that God himself has done evil. To claim to be the Messiah, though, was not understood to be a claim about God. So he's just saying, I'm a rescuer. I'm one who has come to save you from your enemies. That's not saying anything about God. That's saying something about him. And so they weren't concerned about blasphemy when he says he is the Christ. But the second question the high priest asked, the chief priest, He says, are you the son of the blessed? Now, in those days, the Jewish people often would not say the word God. And so they would substitute it. When he's asking, are you the son of the blessed? He's asking, are you the son of God? A simple yes or no would have answered the question. Yes, I am. No, I'm not. But Jesus wants to be as clear as he possibly can. And so he responds, I am. Remember when Moses was on the mountaintop and God said, go and lead my people? And Moses said, all right, God, if I tell them that you sent me, who do I say sent me? Like, what's your name? I don't even know you that well. What does God say to Moses? I am. Yahweh. Tell them that I am sent you. This is the name of God. Jesus says, am I the Son of God? I am Yahweh. That's who I am. So the high priest says, are you the Son of God? He says, look, I am Yahweh, God of Israel. I am your Lord and Master. I am the Creator God. I am the one you must worship. That's what he's saying in his response. And if that's not clear enough to them, Jesus quotes from the prophet Daniel, who makes a very explicit statement. Look at what he says here. Daniel said, I saw in the night visions, and behold, with the clouds of heaven, there came one like a son of man. And he came to the Ancient of Days and was presented before him. And to him was given dominion and glory and a kingdom, that all peoples, nations, and languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion, which shall not pass away, and his kingdom one that shall not be destroyed. When Jesus says, you will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven, he's referring to this passage. Now, in this context, the clouds of heaven refer to the very glory of God. It was the Shekinah glory. When God went into his temple, when it was dedicated by Solomon, there was this pillar of fire, the pillar of smoke that the Jewish people followed around. That ends up in the temple, in the Holy of Holies, above the Ark of the Covenant. That is the very presence of God. Jesus says, when you're going to see me, am I God? Am I the Son of God? You see my glory. You see who I am. See, this Son of Man that Daniel is talking about, he said, look, the person's human, but Daniel's having trouble understanding what's going on. Because this human, this person just like you or me, stands in the presence of the Ancient of Days, God himself on his throne, and he receives the dominion and glory and the kingdom that belongs to God himself. Daniel's like, how is it that a human can have the glory of God? How is it that a human can be God? That's the miracle of the incarnation. Jesus became a man. The Son of God became the Son of Man. And he's coming with the glory of God. Because the Son of Man is God. See, when the high priest asks Jesus, are you the Son of God? Jesus is forthright. Yes, I am the Son of God. See, there's no more need for secrecy. We've seen lots of times in the Gospel of Mark, especially the first half, whenever Jesus did something that was miraculous, that only God himself could do, Jesus was quick to say, don't go tell anyone. Keep this quiet. Don't tell them who I am. Because Jesus was trying to control the timing of his death. If you go and tell everybody that I'm God, that I'm doing things only God has the right to do, only God has the power to do, they'll kill me, they'll lynch me in a street somewhere, and I won't actually bear the penalty for my people's sins. But there's no more need for secrecy here. There's no more need to keep quiet. You can shout it from the rooftops, Jesus is Lord. Jesus is the Son of Man who is God in human form. We don't need to keep quiet about that anymore. That's why the high priest responds as he does in verse 63. And the high priest tore his garment and said, what further witnesses do we need? You have heard his blasphemy. What is your decision? And they all condemned him as deserving death. Now, the tearing of clothes back then meant the person was experiencing severe emotional trauma. This man is amazing. I have a human being standing before me, tied up in ropes, claiming to be God. Claiming to be the one that I, the high priest, should worship. Now, Jesus broke his silence to answer this question because answering this question truthfully would actually result in his death. The high priest told the others that they heard his blasphemy. Now, the true blasphemy that is happening in this text is the denial that God himself is standing right there in front of them. It's by denying the truthfulness of Jesus' claim, the high priest himself was the blasphemer. The one who speaks truly about God is the one who is accused of lying about God. But he's the only one telling the truth. in this upside-down kingdom of Christ, we see this incredible role reversal. The judge of the entire world, the one who one day will stand as judge of every single man, woman, and child who's ever lived, is being judged by those very people. The chief priests and scribes claim to be standing on the law of God while Jesus is in the dock on trial. When the fact is, Jesus is the only one upholding the law of God. The chief priests and the scribes are breaking it by asking people to lie about Jesus. Break one of the Ten Commandments. Bear false witness against this guy so we can have him killed. Oh, that's murder. In this great role reversal, the guilty chief priests and scribes declare that Jesus himself is guilty of blasphemy and condemn him as one deserving death. The only one who is truly innocent in that crowd is the one who's sentenced to die. And their rage against Jesus is immediate. When they realize what he's actually saying, look at verse 65. And some began to spit on him and to cover his face and to strike him, saying to him, "Prophesy." And the guards received him with blows. They immediately explode in fury at his incredible claim that he is none other than God himself. These men who claim to be defending God do so by spitting on God, by mocking God, by hitting God with their fists. That's how they're defending his honor. See, this is the response of those who refuse to accept and receive the words of Christ. It's not always fists, though. It's easy to look at this group of men and say, yeah, they're pummeling God himself. It's not always fists. I mean, you know, they cover his eyes and they punch him and say, if you are this prophet who knows everything, tell me, what's my name? You can't even see me. Who hit you? Who did it this time? It's not always fists. When we persist in our own rebellion against Christ and who he claims to be, we are taking our own swings at him. When we decide we're going to keep living the same old way, we're telling Jesus, no, I'm God, you aren't. When Jesus says, here's how I want you to live your life, and we tell him, no, I'm not going to live that way, we're saying, you don't get to make those choices. I'm the Lord of Lords. I'm higher authority than you are. When we cheat on our taxes, or sleep with our girlfriend or boyfriend, or we look at the wrong things on the internet, or we spend time worrying, or we spend our time gossiping about others, or we spend time complaining about everything, we're taking a swing at Jesus. We're trying to knock him off his throne. See, too often we think of rebellion against Christ as this kind of open defiance, the willingness to kill him, to nail him to a cross. But more often, the rebellion against Jesus looks an awful lot like ignoring him. We say, oh yes, Jesus is Lord. Sure, he's Lord, but he tells me to not do this. Whatever. It's not that big of a deal. I can do what I want. Too often we think a little rebellion against God is okay, as long as we're good in the big things. I don't kill people. I don't hurt people. It's okay that I'm living a lifestyle that you told me not to live. I'm living, you know, doing things, valuing things that I ought not to value. See, whether you're Peter and just hanging out with the men who beat Jesus, or you're the guards who actually did the beating of Jesus, or you're the chief priests and scribes who openly blaspheme God to his face, we're all rebelling against Christ. The proper response to the claims of Jesus is immediate and obedient faith. There's no other response that is appropriate. It's the willingness to immediately drop to the knee and acknowledge with your lips, Jesus is Lord. It's the willingness to say, I will change whatever in my life needs to be changed because I love him and I want to honor him because he is God. He is worthy of my life. There's no other valid response. You see, Jesus didn't claim to be a good guy. Jesus didn't claim that he was simply a good example for us to follow. Jesus claimed to be the very King of Kings and the Lord of Lords, the Creator God, to whom all praise, honor, and glory is due. You know, in a few minutes, we're going to witness three people get baptized. They're responding to the claims of Jesus that he is Lord, and they're doing it in a visual way. They're being baptized to publicly identify with him, to say, Jesus is Lord, therefore, I am not. come what may, I'm going to do what he tells me to do. I'm going to live the way he tells me to live. And by his power, by his grace in my life, I will be successful. In baptism, they are going to give themselves mind, body, and soul to Jesus. This is the proper response to who Jesus claimed to be. It's the only response. How dare we respond in any other way?